winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Well, for the first time in 7 years, the state budget isn't just late, it's way late.
Casey, we often say we tape this program on Friday morning because things could change.
Things have been breaking on Fridays and Saturdays.
That's right. So. On Wednesday evening, though, Governor Andrew Cuomo sat down in the Red Room to explain where they have agreements and what issues are still preventing us from having a budget for the new fiscal year.
We have agreement on the millionaire's tax, on a middle-class tax cut, on a water program that was actually passed, on ride sharing, on college affordability, on workers' comp, on property tax reform and citizen empowerment to get people involved in their state and local taxes and that discussion. We have the agreement on a prescription drug program, which is the first in the nation, on an opioid program, which is a very aggressive program. So we've done a lot of good work. Open issues. Raise the age. On raise the age, the last sticking point, the current sticking point, which you can go from sticking point to sticking point across the morass. The current sticking point is who does supervision of people who are discharged from what we call hybrid facilities? Does DOCS correction do supervision over discharged people, or does OCFS? Raise the age, remember, we've talked about it for many, many years, and it hasn't passed for many, many years, because it really is the most political polarizing issue, right? Depending on your philosophy, this is a, can be, an ideologically polarizing issue. Criminal justice laws usually are lightning rods for ideological differences. And raise the age poses a very important but controversial theory. What do you do with a 16 and 17-year-old, and how do you treat them? And it may be a 16 and 17-year-old that did a bad act, maybe a 16 and 17-year-old that actually hurt someone. And how do you treat them? Are they a criminal, or should they be locked up? Or do we give them a second chance, and do we try to rehabilitate them? And what is that balance? That's what Raise the Age poses. If you are a Republican conservative, you see it one way. If you are a Democratic liberal, you see it a different way. So that's what Raise the Age has been posing. That is still an open issue. There's an issue with the Affordable New York program, the old 421A program, which sometimes was what they would say linked to rent reform, where they both expired at the same time. They are now separated because of the delay in passing the new Affordable New York plan. So that is an issue of concern more to the Assembly. And then there's an issue of education funding, specifically charter funding. There's always an issue of education funding, how it's distributed. It's especially complicated this year because there is a law that is on the books that concerns charter schools that really throws a wrench into the machine of government. There is a charter school law that has frozen the tuition increase to charter schools for a number of years. That law expires this year in June. When the law expires, charter schools automatically receive a $1,500 increase per student. And that amount is to be paid by the local government. So for example, New York City, the increase would be $1,500 per student. It would be $200 million to New York City. That happens automatically. The $1,500 is a windfall to the charter schools, I would say. charter schools would say they deserve it because their tuition was frozen for a long period of time, and this is really paying them back for past increases that they didn't receive. But $1,500 per student is a very large number. And it happens automatically. The assembly is opposed to the $1,500 increase. However, if the assembly does nothing, inaction automatically gives the charter schools a $1,500 increase. So in other words, it's a unique situation in some ways. If the assembly does not act, they have actually acted to give charter schools a $1,500 increase. The only way the charter schools don't get a $1,500 increase is if the Senate agrees to pass a new bill that would restrict or reduce that $1,500. So this is, in many ways, an unprecedented situation. This year, flexibility to me financially is very important. The federal government, I was in Washington federal government for 8 years, as you know. Federal government operates under something called the continuing resolution. That is a customary budget device. What a continuing resolution says is we are not going to set a budget for the full year. We are going to set certain agencies' budgets for certain periods of time. And then you can adjust. In this landscape that changes on almost a weekly basis, that is the kind of financial flexibility we need here. Picking a number now and saying this is going to be the number and not knowing what's going to happen next week and next month and when the federal government passes the budget or when they don't pass a budget or when they do the next continuing resolution is very hard. So I am looking for continued financial flexibility in the budget process, but certainty and permanence in the operations that need to continue, which is what we accomplished in the extender.
Time now to analyze the unusual week in Albany at the Reporters Roundtable. My partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, is your moderator.
All right, no sleep till budget. Joining us now at the Reporters Roundtable are two of the weary kind. Mike Gormley from Newsday and from my own paper, the Times Union. Rick Harlan, who just yawned audibly before the camera started rolling. All right, so what are the issues? We heard the governor kind of summarize the three big issues that are still hanging. 421A renewal, the expiration date thereof, charter school funding, and an issue on who would supervise youthful offenders released from youth detention facilities. As we talk on Friday morning, we seem to have agreement on those, but could things still blow up again?
Sure, because the bills haven't been written yet, and we've seen this for a week. They say we're close, but there's details, and the devil is always in the details. And if there's something they don't like about, for instance, the youth panels, that is objectionable to one side, that could halt everything, or something about when the 421A gets renewed. The Senate probably wants a longer horizon, the Assembly wants a less, and they could be quibbling about that. So certainly it's not done until it's done, until the budget is written and presented.
March 28th, the governor said he had agreement on just about everything in the budget. Is really almost saying we had a tentative agreement on the 28th. And since then, it's blown up several times. So as Rick said, and as you know, we have to be able to read those voluminous bills to see what's in here.
We're waiting on the revenue bill. That it mm-hmm. looks like, as we talk on Friday morning, it looks like that's the only bill that hasn't been printed. And as we've gone through the bills that have already been passed in the Senate and in the Assembly, after the Senate's now gone, the Assembly is still in Albany as we're talking now and still apparently going to pass bills. They're going to take up apparently the capital projects bill. We've seen intentionally omitted in all of these bills. Basically, everything is being shoveled into the revenue bill. Isn't that right?
This is part of the problem. I mean, you call it a revenue bill. revenue doesn't have an awful lot to do with this bill. The governor has, what other governors have done, but Governor Cuomo has done this more than anyone has ever done before. He's inserted policy that he wants into the budget. Now, that's because under budget law, a governor has extraordinary power, leverage over the legislature, because as he is now, he can put what's in what he wants into his budget extenders. The legislature is forced by law either to accept it or to reject it. If it rejects it, it threatens to shut down government.
It really means more than ever that this budget negotiation period is really becoming the de facto end of the legislative session, because so many of the policy issues are going to be decided in that revenue bill. After that, they're sort of gearing up for next year after the budget, in a sense.
The governor in his press conference talked about the need that he still believes needs to be addressed in the final budget to give state government, I think probably he means him, the authority to make mid-fiscal year changes in the event of a drop in federal aid, particularly, and apparently the hill he's going to die on is Medicaid. If there's a potential Medicaid cut from the feds, he wants to first give the legislature the option to come up with a solution. If not, the budget director, meaning Cuomo, would have power to make across-the-board cuts to service providers.
This is a line that the governor put into his budget proposal in January, just buried in the budget. Newsday and others, we found this. It was a line that would basically give him unilateral control after the budget is set. The Senate and the Assembly eliminated it right away. The governor brought this back in recent days. He wants to have this leverage to be able to come here, and basically he expects that would give him unilateral power to cut the budget if there are cuts in Washington, which we expect. Now, what's interesting about this big power play that we're watching, and there's some major forces beyond the specific issues of this budget at play here. The governor has a situation where he can force the legislature to accept that proposal, and if they don't, he can force it through a whole by continuing extenders, which means every few months he could continue the 2016-17 budget any way he wants.
And the legislators don't get paid until there's a final budget. And for some of the, I think especially in the Assembly, for some of them, it's going to really start to make a difference. There are Assembly members that, you know, some of them, this is what they do. This is their job. They don't have, not all of them have big lucrative law practices
on the side. Doesn't that pressure fall harder on Democrats?
Yeah, the Assembly Democrats,
because more of them have their legislative gig as their only job.
That's where you see more sort of career activist politician types. Republicans generally, a lot of them are businessmen turned politicians.
Yeah. And many of those,
not totally, but
many of those Assembly Democrats are in the city where it's incredibly expensive on that salary as well.
They might have families. They might be the sole
breadwinner. So who has the hot hand right now? From the discussion to this point, it would seem to be the governor.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he does. I mean, he the Senate, though, is, you know, they can last longer probably financially. It's for most of the, at least the Senate Republicans, this lack of a pay check is probably not that big of an issue. They can probably hold out. And we saw that this week when on Wednesday the governor had a press conference saying, you know, we've sort of hit a deadlock, and the Senate just, they went home. And they're, you know, some of them are out of town, some of them are on vacation. And I think that is what it is, but it's also a signal, I think, to the Assembly Dems and to the governor from the GOP Senate saying, hey, we're in no rush. We have certain things we want. We can wait as long as you want to wait.
There's several legislators who are questioning whether the governor was negotiating in good faith for an on-time budget, which he always wanted before, because he's in the situation now where he does have this nuclear option, where he's got almost complete leverage over the legislature on this to do what he wants.
In the press conference, I was sitting next to you at the governor's Red Room press conference, and you were relentless in pushing him on the question of, wait a minute, Governor, the implication was you only figured out that there's this federal peril now. What changed since January?
Right. Well, actually, since November, when he started to warn about this, and we all knew that this was a possibility. But he was, up until the day that that some legislators think he blew up the budget deal, he was talking about being very close. As I said, March 28th said we're close to a budget. And then all of a sudden, the concern of federal budget cuts, which haven't happened yet, rose, and that became his reason for saying he needed to have this financial flexibility.
He's trying to kind of have it both ways here, though, too, because if he's really, I mean, if they're, okay, there is concern about what the Feds are going to do, but then, okay, then why not just say, okay, we're waiting no matter what until June, because we just don't know. But on the same time, they're still working to complete the budget. So if they complete the budget today or next week, they'll say, victory, we finally have a great budget. There still is that issue of the federal Medicaid dollars. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's the overriding concern, then you could argue just put everything on hold until we have a clearer picture.
Let's
there.
Compare and contrast this to the last time New York State had, I almost said enjoyed budget extenders, mm-hmm. but I don't think anybody enjoys them. And that was in 2010, the last year of David Paterson's governorship. He was not running again. And the budget lagged on until August, the last 6 weeks or so, because the Senate could not pass once again a revenue bill. Mm-hmm. What's the compare and contrast there?
Well, I would argue that we're in a very different time now. Governor Paterson was facing real, that were happening, billions of dollars in lost revenue for the state.
Yeah.
It was the Great Recession. He was acting on a real issue rather than one that appears to be coming this way. Also, I would argue, and I think everyone would probably agree, you've got a different kind of leadership in the Senate and the Assembly now, very responsible to that sort of thing, less about fiefdom. They work together better, and I think that you
meaning
would find...
Meaning Carl Hastie and John Flanagan work better together?
Speaker Carl Hastie work, and Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan work better together, but I think they also have a different attitude. They're not trying to protect their chamber as much as previous leaders had. They're trying to really be a partner in government. So I think you have an opportunity to actually get these cuts collectively, if the governor wants it that way.
Paterson really pioneered that concept of packing everything into the budget and
offering
an extender, yeah. a budget mm-hmm. extender, which is a take it or leave it option for the lawmakers. If they leave it, then okay, we have a government shutdown, and nobody wants to be tarred with that. And it dates back to there. And previous to that, we have the Pataki versus Silver versus Pataki decision in the 90s that really set the tone legally in the court decision that the governor does have this power over the budget.
I think people tend to forget one of Andrew Cuomo's strongest weapons in the budget was handed to him by Governor David
right.
Paterson.
Mm-hmm.
Setting aside the federal question, the specific policy issues here, how much of this impasse is due to bad blood that has grown up between the legislature and the governor? Going back to November with the governor's sabotaging, I don't think that's overstating it, of the pay raise commission, his appointees basically blew up that deal and denied lawmakers their first raise in 18 years, and then continuing in January with his decision to really scrap the traditional state of the state delivered to lawmakers and said he took it on the road to basically hand-picked audiences. I mean,
well, I would say that the Governor Cuomo basically eliminating or quashing the pay raise, the first pay raise since 1999 for legislators, that was an illustration of the bad blood. It was coming up. There's been bad blood since the governor came in, running against Albany, setting up corruption commissions aimed only at the legislature. There's a lot of this going on.
And then closing
them down when
they got too close
to
home.
Right.
So
the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
So December was very difficult because he stopped a raise, and the legislature seemed to almost be getting over that, and now he's denying their pay.
And the Senate, I think, is some of the Senate Republicans are still upset. They feel like maybe they were dragged into, well, they voted for it, but they were dragged into the minimum wage deal and the family leave deal. Although I think that the feelings are probably harder in the Assembly, where the raise issue resonated a lot stronger.
And there are ideological differences as well.
Of course, that always remain. I'll put you on something of the spot. We're coming into a scheduled two-week Easter break. As noted, on Friday morning as we're talking, the Assembly is still in town. The Senate has bugged out. Will this impasse last beyond the Easter break? In other words, will we not get a final deal until after that holiday season, as it were?
Well, I guess it's just, there might be an option in between. They might be coming back early from the the break after Easter, after Passover. We'll have to see what the Senate says. As Rick noted, the Senate Republicans are not in as big a hurry to start the paychecks to get this done, so they could continue for a few weeks.
Rick, do you think until after Easter?
Boy, that's a tough one. I'd say at least give it Easter and then maybe after Easter.
Okay. All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to the two of you. I say rest up, but I might jinx you. Thanks very much to Mike Gormley of Newsday and Rick Carlin of the Times Union. And now we'll kick it back to Matt at the desk.
This week's New York Now poll question: should controversial bills be included in the state budget? Bills like Raise the Age, for example. Let us know by logging on to our website, nynow.org. Last time we saw you, we asked, how important is an on-time state budget? And the majority saying, somewhat. Joseph in Columbia County told us, while an on-time budget is desirable, it isn't more important than a good budget. And finally, Charles in Bronxville said, while the state legislators should do everything possible to get a state budget passed by April 1, it is not absolutely essential. Thanks again to all those who took the time to respond. You can do so this week by heading to nynow.org. There you will find all of our past programs, our podcasts, and links to us on social media, including Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll also find a link to the Capital Confidential blog run by Casey and his crew. It's also on timesunion.com. This Monday on PBS is the beginning of a three-part, six-hour series on World War I. Many of the key figures involved in the war to end all wars are not well known, including Albany's Henry Johnson. Advocates in the capital city had pushed for recognition of his bravery for decades. Our television station here in the Capital Region has produced a film detailing his story. It airs this coming Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. on WMHT. Here's a preview.
World War I was the first war fought for ideals, fought to make the world a better place.
We were not the world military superpower. We were nothing like what we became in World War II, but World War I puts us on that path. In Harlem, in New York City, they're essentially saying, look, if we're going to be equal citizens, we need to be able to be armed. You need to trust us with weapons. The creation of the 369th then comes out of that.
There were issues.
Why would they fight for a country that wasn't fighting for them?
They knew that there was more to this than just an adventure, than just youthful bravado, than to show the world who an American was.
Henry Johnson does not fit the stereotype of a war hero. He wasn't some brawling street fighter. He was a redcap. He was a little guy who spent his pre-war career saying, yes, sir, can I take your bag? Well, thank you very much. The story of Henry Johnson is the story of being able to change people's minds.
He's a black hero, but he should be an American hero.
Now, also next Thursday, if you live in the Capital District or the Southern Tier, you will be able to watch a special edition of our program as we conduct a live town hall with Republican Congressman John Faso.
Faso is in the hot seat right now. He was a yes vote on the American Health Care Act, the so-called repeal and replace health care bill, which, of course, was scuttled last month. He's faced a lot of questions on that. Faced a lot of heat from Governor Andrew Cuomo as one of the co-authors of the so-called Collins-Faso Amendment with Chris Collins of Buffalo that would have obligated the state to pick up the county share of Medicaid, which is, of course, a big cost to a lot of counties, all the counties almost around the state. The Governor Cuomo pushed back and said, are you kidding me? This would end up forcing us to either cut Medicaid or vastly increase taxes on New Yorkers to pick it up. Faso pushed back and said the governor's got a lot of places that he could cut, including in his development efforts.
Perhaps Andrew Cuomo will be watching on Thursday. You can join us live on WMHT-TV in the Capital Region or WSKG in the Southern Tier, or online at nynow.org. The events will also be live streamed, including an extra 15 minutes on the web. Again, you can live stream us if you live outside the congressional district at nynow.org, and you can follow along on Twitter with the hashtag FasoTownHall.
Well, that'll do it for us. We end the program today with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor talking to a sold-out crowd this week at the State University at Albany. I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union.
And I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.
For those kids who live in the streets, there's virtually no hope. There is no escape for idle hands. You can think there are, But if you're left to your own devices as a child, you're never going to find your way out. That's why I'm such a big supporter of after-school programs of every kind. My salvation was not living on the streets. And I think the salvation of most kids is when they're supervised. It doesn't have to be, and sometimes it can't be, by your parents. My mother had to work. Lots of parents have to work. They can't be there. They have to survive. But we have to provide alternatives for those children, alternatives that will give them a chance to grow in a healthy way. Because if we leave them in the streets, we've lost them. And it's very hard to retrieve them after that. So for me, I got out through keeping busy.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.